Hello and welcome to the Health Advocate podcast. My name is Rebecca Haddock and I'm the Executive Director for Knowledge Exchange at the Australian Healthcare and Hospitals Association. Today I'm joining you from beautiful Ngunnawal country and would like to pay my respects to the Ngunnawal people and their elders past, present and emerging. Welcome to this special episode of the Health Advocate podcast presenting the second John Deeble Lecture. The John Deeble Lecture has been established by the AHHA to commemorate the life and achievements of distinguished scholar, health economist and health policy leader, Professor John Deeble, co-architect of Australia's universal healthcare system, Medicare. This year's lecture was delivered by Mr. Michael Brennan, Chair of the Productivity Commission, on the 26th of October 2022 at the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra. The lecture was followed by a panel discussion featuring eminent health policy leaders from around Australia and will be released as a follow-up episode of the Health Advocate podcast. Please enjoy the following recording of the 2022 John Deeble Lecture.
Welcome everyone to the second John Deeble Lecture and panel discussion presented by the Australian Healthcare and Hospitals Association and sponsored by Skills IQ. My name's Kylie Woolcock and I'm the Chief Executive of the Australian Healthcare and Hospitals Association, or as we like to say, AHHA. Before we proceed, I'd like to first acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the Indigenous Australian peoples on whose land we're currently meeting. It's important to acknowledge the significance of our Australian Indigenous heritage, that our Indigenous peoples never ceded their lands or their culture, and to reflect on the remarkable understanding that is generously shared by Indigenous peoples, particularly reframing health and wellbeing in a deeply holistic way that both encompasses people and place. Today's lecture is in tribute to the life and achievements of Professor John Deeble. While John is recognised as the father of Medicare, he was also a distinguished scholar, health economist, and health policy leader. This year marks the fourth anniversary since his death on October 5th, 2018. Today, John's legacy is also carried on through the work of AHHA's research arm, the Deeble Institute for Health Policy Research. Established and named in 2011, John was the Institute's patron. The day's event was to be moderated by Professor Anna Peters, Director for Institute for Health Transformation at Deakin University and Chair of the Deeble Institute Advisory Group. Unfortunately, COVID has had its impact today, and as such, I will hopefully take her place and hopefully do her justice. Before I introduce Mr. Michael Brennan, Chair of the Productivity Commission, who will deliver this year's lecture, I would like to just highlight some housekeeping. This afternoon's agenda can be accessed on the screen where you can find a QR code. It's also located around the room. Coming? Maybe? There it is. If you could please switch your phones and devices to silent during today's proceedings. Please feel free to tweet using the hashtags hashtag John Deeble Lecture or hashtag Healthcare Workforce. In case of emergency, we'll be following the directions of National Portrait Gallery staff members. Toilets are located just round to the right-hand side. And finally, AHHA staff will be taking photos and video footage and audio recordings throughout the event. For possible publication on social and other media, could you please let AHHA staff know if you would prefer not to be part of this? You can pick us because we've got different name tags to everybody. I would now like to introduce Associate Professor Rebecca Haddock. Rebecca is the Executive Director for Knowledge Exchange at the AHHA, where she leads the work of the Deeble Institute for Health Policy Research. And Rebecca will speak about John and some of his life achievements. Thanks, Rebecca.
So thank you, Kylie. It is a pleasure and indeed an honour to be speaking to you today about Professor John Deeble, who passed away on October the 5th, 2018, at the age of 87. John, in partnership with Professor Richard Scotton, who passed away the following year in 2019, conceived the idea of a compulsory national health insurance scheme based on the principles of universal coverage, equity of access, and payment according to one's means through the taxation system. If one was to describe John in a single paragraph, it would go something like this. Professor John Deeble was co-architect of Australia's first universal health system, Medibank, and an integral part of its reintroduction as Medicare in 1984. His expertise lay in being able to think innovatively about big issues while never losing sight of the humans who were affected by them. He was a conceiver, implementer, and defender of universal healthcare for nearly 50 years. Such skills and insights do not come overnight, but are built on strong practical and theoretical foundations, and John did the hard yards in health from coalface to theory and back again. He worked in a bank, then he had a short stint in the Navy, as well as completing a degree in commerce. He also worked as assistant manager at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Institute, where he was in charge of finances. And it was during this time it troubled him that people refused to undergo cancer treatment because they could not afford it. So he returned to university to study hospital costs and gained a diploma of hospital administration from UNSW. In 1965, John secured a position at the University of Melbourne, where he met Dick Scotton, and the idea of a compulsory public national health insurance scheme based on the principles of universal coverage took hold. The story of how John Deeble and Dick Scotton, encouraged by Gough Whitlam and Bill Hayden, developed the original Medibank proposals from the mid to late 1960s onwards has been told many times. Less well known are the 2.5 years of implementation battles, including rejection in the Senate 3 times, a double dissolution election, and the eventual passing of the legislation in a joint sitting of both houses in 1974. John proved to be much more than an ideas man. He could also nurture, develop, implement, and defend an idea. He was dogged and courageous in the face of hostility and criticism, but, as became his hallmark, always playing the issue, not the person. Medibank was finally delivered in July 1975, and for the first time, everyone could have free access to a public hospital as a public patient. However, not long after, Medibank was progressively dismantled by the Fraser government, and John moved on to other things. But in 1980, sensing a possible change in government, John strategically teamed with Neil Blewett, then Shadow Minister for Health, and on the 1st of February 1984, they were able to make universal healthcare rise again as Medicare. John remained active in health policy into his 80s, and while time does not permit me to go into the details, it is worth noting again that John was more than an academic. Dick Scotton put it this way when talking about the original Medibank scheme. A key part of John's role was to be roving ambassador, forever seeking ingenious compromises and innovative ways in which the transition to new ways of doing things might be smoothed. In this, he experienced some successes and along the way learned a lot about human frailty and deviousness. He retained his characteristic optimism throughout. So ideas, hard yards, lived experience, persistence, ingenious compromise, doggedness, courage, commitment, empathy, kindness, decent statistical information, humanity, play the issue, not the person, and optimism. These are the lessons that John Deeble offers us for successful health policy reform and implementation in Australia. Let me conclude with the honourable words. Let me conclude with the words of the Honourable Bill Hayden, who wrote to us on the occasion of his death. He said, and I quote, "You will recall the old blinkered quip, if all the economists were laid end to end, they could never reach a conclusion." Well, nothing was further from the truth in the case of John and his scholarly colleague, Dick Scotton. Thank you, John. Everyone in Australia today has the world's best access to health services because of your efforts. So it's now my great pleasure to introduce Michael Brennan, Chair of the Productivity Commission, who will be joining us to deliver the second John Deeble lecture. I'll just give you a brief introduction, Michael, if I may. So Michael, as you all know, is Chair of the Productivity Commission. Previously, he was Deputy Secretary for the Fiscal Group in the Federal Treasury, with responsibility for budget policy, retirement incomes, Commonwealth-state relations, social policy and infrastructure financing. Before that, he was Deputy Secretary, Economic Division in the Victorian Department of Treasury and Finance. Michael has also worked as an Associate Director in the Economics and Policy Practice at PricewaterhouseCoopers and as a Senior Advisor to Treasurers and Minister for Finance at the state and federal levels. Michael is currently working on the Productivity Review Inquiry, Closing the Gap Review, and National School Forum Agreement Studies. And in addition to his role of chair, Michael has also worked on the expenditure on children in the Northern Territory study. But it's with much pleasure that I would like to welcome to the stage today, Michael. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rebecca, and thank you very much to the Deagle Institute and the AHHA for having me here today. I too would like to add my acknowledgement of country, acknowledge the Ngunnawal people as the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather today, and pay my respects to elders past and present. It's hard to say this without sounding a bit trite, but it is an enormous privilege to be here giving a talk in honour of John Deagle. John Deagle represents the best in Australian public policy. A lean intellect, a clear-sighted commitment to evidence-based policy, and the ability to think big. Perhaps most important of all, an unwavering commitment to the public good. Now, many of you, I'm conscious, knew John personally or through some institutional connection like the AHHA or Commonwealth Department of Health, the Peter Mac, the Melbourne Institute, etc. I did not. What I can say is that John was well known to the Productivity Commission, and because he had been an active contributor, an active participant in a number of our inquiries and studies. And some weeks ago, a colleague of mine approached me in the office kitchen, and having become aware of the fact that I was giving this talk, talked to me enthusiastically about the lasting impression that John Deagle had had on him. So John had provided input on a PC project back in 2012, which was one comparing the efficiency of public and private hospitals. John made a formal submission, which is still there on the public record, after the publication of our draft report. And that submission was, as you would expect, strong on technical detail and the in-depth knowledge of the sector. But what's more striking about it, I think, is its tone. It was educative in the best sense. It was pointing out where our analysis could be improved, where the discussion could be sharpened. Bearing in mind, he was a giant and we were mere mortals coming at this issue without a lot of subject matter expertise. And my colleague recalled talking to John on the margins of one of the public hearings. I think a cigarette might have been involved. And they'd had quite a lengthy chat about health policy and health economics. And my colleague said this about John. He said, John was willing to discuss the economics of Australian healthcare with me personally, and I really appreciated that at the time. In this way, he was an inspiration. Soon after this work, I went and started a Masters of Public Health in order to further my understanding. And I should mention that this particular individual, sadly, is leaving the Productivity Commission to go and work in the Victorian Department of Health very shortly. So while John's policy legacy is well known, there was clearly something more. There was, in his humility and generosity, a capacity to inspire young policy officers. And that creates a multiplier effect of unknown but kind of inestimable value. It's running out of juice, I think. How's that? I'll just have to project, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry. Thanks, Colin. So today, as much as ever, we need health policy thinking in the spirit of John Deagle, that which is rational, fearless, prepared to grapple with the big realities, like the aftershocks of COVID, the demand pressures from an ageing population, and the supply pressures associated with workforce. And if that wasn't enough, I want to add one more pressure, namely the slowing of productivity growth in Australia and across much of the developed world. And I want to put to you that this is an issue with significant bearing on health policy that warrants our attention, particularly in the context of health workforce issues. I can sense that less than audible groan of productivity, dry topic, but let me try and paint it on a slightly broader canvas for you. The stylized facts are these. For the last 200 years in Western Europe, and for the European community at least, in Australia and North America, living standards rose at a rate unprecedented in human history. And as our own recent interim report of the Productivity Review states, this rapid advance came as a result of the ongoing discovery and spread of new useful ideas. Some took the form of new technology, like electricity or antibiotics. Others were new business models like mass production or ride sharing. Still others were institutional innovations like accounting standards, capital markets, or free trade. But the change was felt across all sectors of the economy: agriculture, transport, manufacturing, retail, and of course health. Two of the most significant gains of the last century were the dramatic fall in infant mortality and the reduction in death from infectious diseases.
But we sometimes describe that as the output or the outcome of the health sector, and I've certainly done that. But in that sense, that's not entirely right, because not all of the improvement in health outcomes can be attributed to the health sector per se. Much of it was unrelated to increased public or private spending on doctors or hospitals. A lot of it were due to the major contributors like clean running water and sewerage and refrigeration. But it is true that the practice of medicine over that period from the late 19th century through to today was transformed from a state, say, 250 years ago of what you might describe as folk remedies and localised quackery to a profession, or more accurately, a group of professions much more closely cohering around scientific discipline and rigorous training. Hospitals themselves were transformed from places of infection and filth to places where modern medicine is practiced and people go to be treated and cured of illness. A broad, stylized fact is that the improvements in health came about all on one dimension, namely improved quality, not reduced cost. So better health outcomes, longer life expectancy, less pain, fuller lives. Whereas productivity growth in several other industries, including agriculture and manufacturing, took the form of dramatic reductions in cost. That is, a dramatic reduction in the amount of labour required to produce goods that are of everyday consumption value. So just as an example, we've estimated that in 1901, a bicycle, which was then the staple form of transport for the typical Australian, would cost the average worker about 473 hours of labour at the average wage in order to purchase. Today it would take 6 hours. So that's a very stark demonstration of the way productivity growth can lead to dramatic cost reductions in terms of the common items to be purchased for the average person, albeit over a very long time horizon. And wherever that happened, wherever less labour was required to produce basic household goods, there's been a tendency for employment to shift from those sectors to others to satisfy new human wants and needs. So, for example, agriculture employed 25% of the workforce in 1900. Today it's less than 5%, but producing vastly more food and fibre. The trajectory in services is the opposite, towards higher employment, higher share of the workforce. And this is one of the big stories of the last several decades. The steady shift of employment into the services sector, with health leading the way, leading the march. Now, you can attribute some of that to a shift in people's preferences, but that isn't the whole story. Partly, as I say, it reflects the cost reductions going on in other parts of the economy. The Australian economy is now 80% services, 90% as a share of the workforce. To be a high-income country today, to be a high-productivity country, is to have a high-productivity services sector. There is no other way. And future productivity growth, future income growth, relies on high-productivity growth in the services sector. And that turns out to be quite a significant challenge. It's not just that productivity growth is a bit less intuitive in the services sector than it was in sectors like agriculture and manufacturing and mining, though that is true. It is a much less intuitive concept for somebody employed in aged care or the NDIS, or for that matter, health. But it is also that many of the forces that drove significant productivity growth in those aforementioned traditional sectors, things like economy of scale and mass production and cheaper energy, substituting labour for capital, are on the whole likely to be less applicable in the services sector. Services tend to be delivered in person. Not always, but mainly. They're often bespoke by their nature. And there's an important sense in which a service is co-produced by the provider and the consumer together. So even in health, a lot of the innovation that does occur is what one might describe as the manufacturing or the R&D side of the health business. It's the new drugs, the devices, the equipment, the new diagnostic tests. Less so on the service side. Less so in terms of new business models or configurations of service delivery. The health sector is a leading edge innovator when it comes to medical technology, less so when it comes to the adoption of general technology like digital communications or data analytics to support innovative new business models. In other fora, I have at times, you know, referred to the riddle of being referred off to pathology, you know, cutting edge diagnostic tests by a pathologist. And the referral occurs by fax, and you're kind of left sort of scratching your head. And I think that is part of the reason why productivity growth in health has tended to be quality enhancing, but rarely cost reducing. So the intergenerational report tells us about the cost pressures that we face on the demand side due to the ageing of the population, health spending by the Australian government to increase by about 1.6 percentage points of GDP between now and 2060. State and territory spending would add further pressures to that government spending. And if collectively it doesn't sound like much for the Australian government alone, that would be a pressure amounting to about $800 billion of additional spending over that period in constant prices, in real terms. But there's another truth that I think is much less well understood, and that is that it is this, that for all those demand pressures associated with the ageing population, there is a similar cost pressure, a similar pressure operating on the supply side. And it goes like this. It's a continuation of the story I was describing earlier. When productivity growth in the economy is uneven, that is, it's rapidly progressing in some sectors and not in others, then perhaps ironically, it's the sectors with the low productivity growth that expand as a share of the economy and as a share of the workforce. This is a phenomenon known as cost disease and attributed to an economist by the name of William Bomer writing in the 1960s. It's ironic because in many ways a market economy operates to shift resources to the successful firms and the successful business models, etc. But this is one way in which firms and activities, kind of in the face of uneven productivity growth across the economy, resources, notably labour, tend to flow to the sectors that have relatively slow productivity improvement. And unless that pattern changes, the economy-wide productivity growth can then face significant headwinds. The economist Charles Jones put it like this. He said, economic growth is determined not by what we are good at, but by what is essential and hard to improve. So in Australia, the non-market sector, that comprising health, education, other public services, has increased its share of employment over the last two decades from around 20% to 25%. Much of that growth in the last decade. If that growth continued unabated out to 2060, then that non-market share of employment could get closer to something like 40%. It would almost certainly intensify the fiscal pressures on the government. It would certainly intensify the workforce shortages that we currently experience across health and other sectors. Now, of course, productivity growth in the non-market sector is not zero, but it is notoriously hard to estimate. The outcomes can be a bit intangible, they're hard to observe, and as I said, quality is often the main dimension. We know that there are ongoing advances in health. There's no question about that. And medical technology promises more. The potential impact of wearables, the potential impact of genomic sequencing, new applications for messenger RNA. Many of these things, we just don't know. But there will be more. But it is hard in health to know whether all those advances are rising or progressing faster than the rise in the inputs that's required to produce them. And in other non-market services like schools, I think it would be very difficult to make a case to say that there's been any productivity growth in the last 20 years if you're comparing inputs to outputs. So the main path out of this tendency towards cost disease is to achieve some productivity growth in that non-market sector and to complement the quality improvements wherever possible by some real cost reduction where we can find it. None of that is easy for the reasons I outlined earlier. But two observations stand out. One is that the unevenness of productivity growth can be overcome via general purpose technologies like digital communications or data analytics, AI, machine learning, etc., if all sectors are adopting them to try and make use of those new technologies to enable different approaches, different business models. And the second observation is that in those services like health, which rely heavily on a skilled workforce, it's vital that the workforce be well deployed to maximum efficiency and effectiveness. So we should look at these issues, I think, through a positive lens. There are worthwhile opportunities in healthcare, and there is a major role for the workforce in achieving those. I want to start with something a bit subtle about health, and that is the word patient, because it's an interesting word that betrays a kind of, interesting set of assumptions about our expectations of people using the system, namely that, I guess, they wait. The Commission estimated some time ago that the hidden cost of just waiting in doctor's offices amounted to about $1 billion a year. And a US clinician summed up an alternative approach with the provocative title, "The Patient Will See You Now." It brings into focus the much broader question of person-centred care and how the health workforce's attitudes can improve outcomes and experiences. So measurement of the performance of the healthcare system is one key part of that. Patient-reported experience measures, patient-reported outcome measures and the like. But little things matter to change how healthcare workforce interacts with people. In our own study of innovations in care for chronic health conditions, we looked at the Perth Homeless Healthcare Team, which established a patient reference group comprising people experiencing homelessness, an incredibly vulnerable and disadvantaged group, to give their views on the most effective ways of providing services to them. We also became aware of a community hospital that took the concept of person-centred approach to heart and looked at every feature of their operations from a customer perspective, assigned a person to focus on workplace culture based around person-centred care. The patients and their families and the community were all involved in the governance of the hospital, and throughout the hospital, large posters urged patients and family members to speak up, ask questions. The key lesson is that a healthcare workforce's skills go well beyond purely clinical dimensions. In a way, the hospital's model of healthcare, in this instance, had to expand to include the people it served, taking to heart that earlier point I made about the co-production of a service between the provider and the consumer. It brings to mind another metaphor, namely the retail industry, which is perhaps not a perfect analogy for health, but bear with me, where the path of innovation and progress has often involved bringing the consumer into the production process. So first by having the consumer walk around the aisles and pick things off the shelves, which of course wasn't the practice in the country store of the 19th century, and then of course later having them scan items, that's probably more of a mixed blessing. The role of the patient is kind of quite important as that co-productive element in the health system. Another place where the role of the patient is becoming more important is the use of peer workers. We found in our mental health report that the peer workforce was a potential important addition to the general workforce, the general clinical workforce, and they could be particularly useful for some groups that found it hard to engage with mainstream services, including those in the LGBTI community. And technology can also give the patient greater scope to take charge of their own healthcare needs, with a reduced role for the omnipresent healthcare worker. That approach means that scarce healthcare workers can help more people, which is particularly valuable in areas where the workforce shortages are most acute. And the technology doesn't have to be complex. This is another instance we found in looking at the innovations in chronic healthcare. But we looked at the Nelly program used by the Southeastern Melbourne PHM, which is basically an SMS-based persona to promote self-care for people with chronic conditions. And it was basically used for a range of reasons, some GPs using it for remote monitoring of blood pressure, others for promoting increased physical activity. Often it was just about reminders of the need to engage with services, etc. A good example of a more sophisticated use of consumer-led technology was the use of online services for the treatment of mental health conditions that we looked at in our mental health report. We looked at the ability of these moderated online services to provide a service to consumers that was effectively a blend of in-person clinician time with other online material and interactive tools. So for example, the program This Way Up found that clinicians were effectively using 10 minutes per fortnight for supported online treatment compared with 1 to 2 hours of face-to-face treatment because the online service was being augmented with other things, interactive tools, other content. And there is a quality and a convenience dimension too. Like all workers, healthcare workers have varying proficiency, but software doesn't. And while software can't do everything, where it does have efficacy, it can provide a consistent quality of service. But it also addresses some of the concerns around stigma in face-to-face models of care. These online, moderated online mental health services, for example, were available at times that people were most likely to use them, including between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. of an evening. So a degree of self-service for some types of healthcare provides scope for consumers to be in charge. It doesn't suit everybody, but it will suit many. In other cases, technology might be largely just about assisting clinicians, such as where AI algorithms are helping to support radiologists in identifying abnormalities, etc. The key point is, from a workforce point of view, that these are opportunities, not threats. The role of technology, for the most part, has been not to replace jobs, but to replace tasks. And in so doing, it tends to augment skilled labour rather than superseding it. It allows humans to focus their attention and their efforts on those uniquely human skills, like judgment and the synthesis of complex information, and empathy and innovation. So technology is playing a significant role, potentially, in person-centred care and in substituting low for high-cost services. But there are other substitution possibilities too that don't necessarily involve technology, where the healthcare workforce can be involved. Unwarranted scope of practice restrictions add to costs and do reduce people's access to treatment and can constrain choice. Stephen Duckett, Michael cautioned me that quoting Stephen Duckett in the Deeble lecture maybe is a faux pas, but Stephen rightly called the use of highly qualified practitioners for activities that required much lower qualifications as squandering the skills in primary healthcare. He found that a wide range of workforce groups, more than 90% saw some scope for workforce substitution, generally to a practitioner with lower skills, including 30% of enrolled nurses thinking they could shift some of their tasks to cleaners. And no doubt satisfaction rates, quite apart from the efficiency issue, satisfaction rates would rise if people were able to have some of these tasks performed by people who were a bit less qualified. There does appear to be significant caution, perhaps excessive caution, about widening the roles of some healthcare workers. Now, obviously, how far that substitution goes has to rely on clinical evidence, not just intuition, but nor should it be informed just by what has often been referred to as protective titles. In California, nurse practitioners are recognised as primary healthcare providers, but they have to be supervised by a physician, whereas in other states, notably Oregon and Arizona, they don't have that supervisory requirement. And a large-scale study by the Federal Trade Commission on outcomes found that the unrestricted model of care had no adverse impacts on health outcomes for for the government's Medicare beneficiary, the US Medicare system beneficiaries. And one of the most contested areas, I guess, in Australia for scope of practice issues is in respect of community pharmacy, where the COVID-19 pandemic saw pharmacists performing a key role in population vaccination. And they have proved their effectiveness in a range of other areas, including opioid treatment. And some in that profession have sought wider roles in healthcare, including embedding pharmacists in aged care facilities. Some have pushed it to another level in terms of trying to divert non-urgent hospital or ED attendances to pharmacists. That would obviously require a degree of caution. But it does appear that there would be some scope to expand the remit of community pharmacy. And certainly the existing model where we have community pharmacies largely operating as retail outlets, selling in addition to prescription medicines, a range of other things with kind of questionable medical efficacy, but propped up by unjustifiable regulatory constraints on location, ownership, competition in general, and restrictions on prescription price discounting. So one attractive option would be to extend the potential for pharmacists and other allied health professionals to play a larger role in multidisciplinary care teams under more integrated healthcare models. Now, there are other obvious forms of substitution that aren't necessarily between different professions or different parts of the workforce, but between different parts of the system. We know that the hospital system is, if you like, the monster of the healthcare system, accounting for about $84 billion of expenditure in 2019-20. And you can throw in about $5 billion of loose change for the MBS and PBS services that are delivered through a public hospital setting. There is a great deal of scope, in principle, for the shifting of activity from hospitals to primary healthcare through better management of chronic disease in particular, which is, of course, a growing proportion of the disease burden. And that means general practice and other primary forms of care and their associated workforce playing a bigger role. As an illustration of the potential outcomes here, the Bunbury Hospital Chronic Conditions Care Coordination Service, bit of a mouthful, in WA saw a 56% reduction in ED presentations and a 16% fall in the length of hospital stays and savings of more than $1.5 million in avoided costs for people who are enrolled in that service. Now, these don't always have immediate fiscal savings to government because there's excess demand for the hospital system. They may have fiscal savings in terms of delayed new hospital construction, But they do have benefits to people, because the hospital setting may not be the optimal setting for many. Now, it's hard to escape the conclusion that funding models are clearly playing some role. Pecuniary incentives aren't everything, but they do matter. And to the extent that we are paying for primary care on the basis of time spent in consultations, specified length, or for hospital care on the basis of activity, we are surely missing out on some of the opportunities, or at least placing impediments in the way of some of the opportunities for improvement. Activity-based funding in public hospitals, since its inception in Victoria in the mid-1990s, has been a very important reform, no question, and as it's been rolled out more generally across the nation. It certainly encourages hospitals to be efficient in their activities, but it does have some downsides. It does encourage activity. It doesn't pay a hospital to reduce activities by managing care better or by making investments in primary care. I don't think we can attribute the lack of coordination across hospitals and primary care purely to the Federation. It's partly around the incentives associated with funding models. We know that in general practice, the fee-for-service arrangements can encourage throughput, but they also encourage service. That's what the funding model effectively incentivises. So whilst there is a role clearly for regulation, there is a role for culture in freeing up the capacity for innovation. Funding models probably are one of the primary sources of rigidity in the existing system. So there's much complexity in a system, and when it's the health system, all the more so. There is no single magic wand or policy lever that of itself creates the necessary change. Large-scale system architecture is part of the story, but only part. For the most part, we will work within the broad policy structure as devised by John Deeble. But within that, we have to continue the quest for funding models that better align practitioner incentives with the public good, and to free up some room for genuine service innovation. We need to think hard about the funding role of our private health insurers, and for that matter, our life insurers, in the suite of patient-centred and preventative care. And as I mentioned earlier, there is the role of community pharmacy in the mix. We also need to foster and support a cultural shift towards more integrated care, less siloed, more patient-centred, more team-based, centred around the consumer. And nowhere is that patient-centred approach more salient than in relation to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, for example. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will legitimately demand a culturally safe environment, both in using health services, but also working in health services, which is fundamental to the important work on closing the gap in health outcomes. So growing and developing the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health workforce is a high priority. And whilst we've made some progress in respect of Indigenous doctors, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are still radically underrepresented in the overall health workforce. We'll need a system with fewer boundaries, including those created by the Federation, one that makes full use of practitioners' full scope of practice, and will increasingly rely on informed and empowered consumers, supported by technology, both medical technology and general technology. New data like PREMs and PROMs and the use of existing data will be central to that endeavour. We'll need to showcase innovation and success stories where we find them. And finally, and to conclude, we'll need a little bit of the ethos of John Deeble. That commitment to the public good, the robust policy analysis aimed at meaningful real-world outcomes that Rebecca referred to earlier, the passion for bringing others along. I opened up with a mention of John's interactions with the Productivity Commission, which of course were just a tiny fragment of his contribution to public policy. But I do want to quote something from the submission that he made to the Commission. As I said, bearing in mind, he was the giant of public policy, health policy. We were the minnows. But the submission he made to our study, having pointed out the technical gaps, the shortcomings in our analysis, and highlighted some areas where improvements could be made, concluded thus. He said, "The comments set out here are not advanced as criticisms, only proposals that might lead to better and more understandable results. The Commission's report is a very important one on a very difficult and complex subject. It is to be congratulated on what has been achieved in a very short time." And I think that paragraph alone tells us a great deal about why John Deeble had the influence that he had, both on policy, but also on people. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Michael. We all always here at LHA enjoy and value having you come to our events. We now have the opportunity to take some questions from the audience. So does anyone would like to kick off discussions while we've got Michael here? Louise, thank you. Please, just introduce yourself when you can speak.
My name's Louise Stone, I'm from ANU. I just had a question about equity. It seems that interventions, technological interventions, seem to increase inequity, particularly AI, possibly from an additive effect of the inequity in research and then working its way down. Has there ever been a system where the people with the most need at the bottom of the hierarchy actually get the best care?
So, as a result of the use of technology specifically, you mean, or in general?
We seem to always optimise the top end. I'm wondering if we've ever had a circumstance where we've optimised the bottom end.
Yeah, so I think it's a very salient question. So leaving aside for the moment the technology, I don't know the answer to that, but it's hard because in systems where the delivery of healthcare is heavily means tested or heavily focused on the bottom end, e.g. Medicaid and Medicare in the United States, obviously the system suffers from its lack of universality, to channel John Deewell. One risk of a universal system is exactly that point, that particularly a fee-for-service system where the structure of the supply side is not determined by government but kind of allowed to emerge via the market is you probably do find more affluent areas and more affluent cohorts better serviced by specialists, GPs, etc. So, yeah, how you get that equity, that focus on where the services are most needed, very good question, because there will probably be some natural tendencies in the system, be it universal or means tested, that will tend to see relatively well-off people maximising their use and their capacity to benefit. Does AI contribute to that? I'd have to think through that. I mean, it certainly does in the sense, to the extent that there is, and I've reflected on this a bit too, there are people kind of taking advantage of what technology can deliver, in effect, outside the system, via wearables, via apps, via all manner of things. And no doubt that's a group that's more technologically savvy, probably have better health in general anyway. They're self-selecting the use of many of these things. In mental health, using apps for effectively like CBT almost. So yes, there is a risk that technology could exacerbate that divide. So yeah, I concede that point, that finding ways to channel effort at where it is needed most will be a significant priority for policy. I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer than that.
Thanks.
Tessa,
you came from Doctors Australia. Thanks for the lecture, and thanks for the question, and I guess I wanted to follow up on that to invite you to think about innovation beyond technology and to think about some of the innovation that's happening in the ways of working and particularly towards better integrated responses to what are really complex needs. And one of the things, and it's a space that we're working in, and one of the things we're finding is that the evaluation, the measurement of outcomes, very rarely looks at the processes around collaboration, around partnership, around integration. So you don't have data to balance with technological innovation to really drive some of those innovations, some of those reforms that are obviously our quality of care, but are potentially also contributing to productivity dividends if we're thinking about reducing the number of interactions that someone is having with emergency department, police, courts, etc. So I think there's a kind of question about how we're measuring and valuing that in the work.
Yeah, so I think that is right. I mean, as I mentioned, I think the evaluation is always challenging because it won't necessarily be dollars saved. There is often a quality dimension. It can be quite intangible. It's hard to get at. That said, sometimes you'd kind of know that it's there, and so you can exercise a bit of human judgment, right, to my earlier point about complementing technology. Just to echo the observation you made at the outset, the when we did this little set of case studies into these innovations in the treatment of chronic illnesses, one of the big conclusions was that they're not technologically sophisticated at all. Like, this is basically the deployment of very basic technology, to your point, to try and innovate the service system. It's not about the medical being at the cutting edge of medical technology per se. So I mentioned the Nelly, which is the SMS service. There's another one, Monash Watch, which was basically the Monash hospital network, which was basically a set of proactive outreach, and you had non-clinician staff making phone calls, keeping in touch with people, and they would have a set questionnaire, and then they would be able to triage the information such that you could kind of economise on the clinician's time, but you're working out who needed a bit of extra focus. There was this one on the Gold Coast, organised by the Gold Coast PHN, that was Primary Sense, which was basically a very, very basic set of data analytics just going into GP software and kind of getting little predictive, you know, elements to sort of flash up, you know, who might be in need of a bit more proactive outreach. It was not kind of complex data integration or anything like that. It was just basic, simple stuff. Similar story in the Northern Territory about community-controlled healthcare, primary health clinics just linking up via Excel spreadsheets and that sort of thing. So in all of these cases, the observation we made is this is not high-tech stuff. This is the deployment of basic technology, but it's the service innovation that sits around that. And I guess the way I reflect, this is not kind of just a personal reflection, but when I think about what are the attributes that one needs to be a service innovator, as distinct from a genius in the lab, right? So the genius in the lab is obviously highly smart, technically gifted, a lot of high cost training going into that individual. Service innovators, what do they look like? Well, they're people with a bit of judgment, they're people with a bit of self-belief, probably a little bit of humility as well, hopefully. The ability to interact with others, to convince others, to sell a vision, to have a vision in the first place, etc. You know, to be a bit resilient when things don't go well, etc. It's a different suite of skills. And, you know, I think we make a mistake when we think of innovation purely in the sort of lab coat kind of context and not, you know, people, because all of these things that we looked at, the one thing they had in common is they were all swimming massively against the tide, right? All of the institutional incentives were going this way, and these were people who were kind of trying to go this way by just doing something a bit different, linking up with other service providers, effectively cutting across the funding models that existed, scrounging around for cash, whatever. It was a pretty sobering story, uplifting as it was.
Thank you. Gillian Skinner, I'm the chair of the board of AWHA. I want to talk about innovation projects that were in place in New South Wales, where I come from, up until a few years. And there's still many, but some were really fantastic. They were driven by some funding, which was provided by the government in a partnership shared arrangement. And there were some fantastic examples of this involving PHNs, GPs, hospitals joining together, particularly successful in country areas like, for example, Western New South Wales. But they were nearly all driven by the enthusiasm of our local individual champions engaging others. And when that person left, the project didn't continue. And when the funding ran out, they disappeared. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still there to a certain extent, but to me, this is the question really is, how do we embed these kind of innovative programs so that is the future? Because the outcomes for those individual, particularly people with chronic illnesses and Aboriginal people out in some of those communities, were phenomenal.
Yeah.
That should be the way of the future. How do we make sure it is?
Cloning. That's a technological thing. No, that is the big story, and it goes to the evaluation question as well, of course, because you could evaluate a program and say, yeah, great, it had all these benefits, etc., but what's the policy implication? Does it make it replicable?
Can I tell you how we did it to start with? I was the New South Wales Health Minister at the time, and each year, every local health district got an increase in their budget. But of course, they all put it into hospitals because that's where the media focus and everything was, a waiting list, emergency department, ramping. But I said, I'm going to set aside a tranche of money that's to go into integrated healthcare. And it's going to be available to you in different formats, districts and hospitals, if you come up with partnerships with the community who also have skin in the game. So everyone had to put their bid in to be able to eligible for a part of that funding. And that's where the real innovation came from. But you've got to maintain it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's been maintained to that extent.
Yeah, and where these things have been tried, they tend to be small in scale relative to the behemoth that is the activity based funding, and that's natural. We looked a bit at the New South Wales Collaborative Commissioning model. Kind of interestingly, there were sort of almost two ways of trying to get the funding integration. So there's the New South Wales Collaborative Commissioning model, as I understand it, was kind of exactly as you put it, Gillian, the hospital network or district sort of combining with the PHN or an alliance of GPs or primary carers, etc., to kind of identify projects and jointly fund them. So there was a sort of a bottom-up or grassroots collaboration associated with that. There have been other models like the health links approach in Victoria, which was a bit more top-down in that it was basically about cashing out a portion of the ADF funding for hospitals to kind of, do other things with. Both of them probably play a bit of a role, right? Like you can see that sort of top-down bit and the bottom-up thing, which is just about, where can we find an appropriate project. But I'd be interested in people's perspectives around the room. When I've talked to people about it in the past, they still point to there are cultural differences between hospitals and PHNs. PHNs very small compared to hospitals and primary healthcare providers in general. The PHNs don't have a lot of money. Yeah, and they're very, that's right, and in a way yet to reach maturity as a model, I guess. So so some are better than others, and I guess we in our modest way feel that we try and play a bit of a role by showcasing these examples of innovation where we find them. The report that we did on this innovations in chronic healthcare was actually commissioned by the treasurers, the KIFA, the state and Commonwealth treasurers. And we presented this report to them and kind of put to them, there are a lot of good things, low cost, that are going on that are worth emulating around the place. And some of these things are being picked up in different PHNs or in different locations.
Gillian, can you pass the microphone
to Paul Burns? Paul Burns from the Northern Territory. Thanks for the talk, Michael. In your talk, you did mention the importance and emergence of prams and prompts. And also the importance of getting the healthcare financing right, which all points towards value-based healthcare. And I'm wondering, joining those dots, what could that look like? Do you have ideas how we can bring funding and mechanisms to reward positive outcomes for patients and experience in outcomes?
So I don't have the precise formulation, right? But I think funding has to—it's key, right? I'll go out on a limb. Surely some blended model has to be part of the solution, right? A purely, perhaps for a determined cohort of patients, consumers, something that isn't pure fee-for-service, has got to be a better solution. There is the sort of implicit premise of the question is there's a lot of devil in the detail, right? Because if you want to go down the sort of healthcare homes type model and you're attached to a particular service, that precludes you from going somewhere else and accessing fee-for-service type service. What if it's not related to your chronic condition, you just need to get a prescription filled for something else, et cetera, or a referral. So that is a complexity. And how do you measure what it is that you're, the value, the outcome that you're trying to go for? So, in one sense, we do have kind of blended models because we have things like practice incentive program. They're not around outcomes, but they're around certain practice issues or the installation of software or whatever it is, management plans for this and that. So, the idea of kind of softening the edges of the fee-for-service stuff isn't new, but the question is how do you make those dollars conditional on on value in ways that are really robust, gamed, and don't kind of have perverse incentives or don't end up kind of disadvantaging people that you want to advantage. I mean, to go back to Louise's point, I mean, you can see, you know, when you tie money to outcomes, you've got to be willing to withhold it. So I don't have a great answer, other than, you know, some of those are the ingredients, but yeah, a lot of design to be thought through.
I'll just turn to Alan now, thanks.
Alan from Australian Rural and Made Allied Health. About 15 years ago, maybe a little longer, the Productivity Commission produced the Health Workforce paper, and that was probably the last one, massively intellectual, tied in with a Commonwealth State agenda that for 3 or 4 years really did start moving towards development of the workforce, work together, trialling scopes of practice extensions led to things like the nurse practitioner measures and MBS, distributional issues, more clinical training, then a political fallout, Health Workforce Australia, some really good work there. In fledgling, it wasn't always perfect, but it was getting there. Well supported, could have done little things now. With all the shortfalls in workforce and disability, aged care, health, it's now the time for another health workforce program similar to that.
I would have to leave that for others to judge. But look, I think the principle of, I'll answer that in a roundabout way, the principle of having a good holistic look at workforce is sound. And I think one of the things that the Productivity Commission brings to work of that nature, in one sense, the fact that we are not experts in health, we kind of almost use that as a virtue. So our act and our DNA require that when we look at these issues, we bring a whole of economy view. So in looking at a workforce shortage in an area like health, or education, or anywhere else, we're trying to look at it from the whole of economy perspective. So it's not enough to kind of say, oh, well, we just need more health practitioners. We need to kind of get them from effectively other professions or whatever. It's kind of got to be more holistic than that. So in a way, that is the virtue that we bring to it, albeit, you know, apropos of the John Deeble quote I mentioned, you know, we're not experts. And, you know, so we try and access the expertise of others. But yeah, I think as a general principle, it's always, you know, it is timely from, you know, periodically to look at these workforce issues. I think part of the challenge, I mean, Michael will probably mention Health Workforce Australia and its, you know, rise and fall, but it's sort of not enough to just sort of do projections, I guess, is the point. You know, projections on the basis of demographic trends or whatever. You kind of have to have some sense of what is the role of policy, where can we economise, because I think, you know, as per my remarks, I think at an economy-wide level, we are having to more than ever think hard about how we economise on the labour input. Some of that's going to be scope of practice, some of it's going to be technology, some of it's going to be different funding models that allow you to, you know, really focus on where the value is most needed.
Stan Yasmin here at front, and Paul, thank you, Michael. You started off talking about how important quality was, and your recent Productivity Commission paper with respect to mode of employment in the care workforce. One of the interesting things I found in reading that is that you make it as though the care workforce is analogous to the allied health workforce, and there is very different practice parameters around the two. Allied Health has got quite a professional practice quality framework around it. The care workforce has none. And it seems to me that one of the things that keeps missing in the whole conversation about workforce and particularly in the circumstances that we find ourselves of needing numbers is that why should that be at the expense of the quality of that workforce? And I'd just be interested in your comments with respect to that.
Mm. Yeah, so I agree. It is a false economy if you just sort of cut corners on quality and say, well, you know, that's just what we have to do. I guess the issue that you raise specifically around this is for the benefit of others, around the use of platform workers, or platforms for, mainly in the non-residential aged care system, so the sort of home care segment of the market. I mean, we were asked to look at that quite narrow question, partly because there was a split recommendation in the Aged Care Royal Commission, one commissioner saying this practice should be banned and the other commissioner not, and the government sending that to us to have a look at. I guess the conclusion that we came to was, A, it's a relatively small part of the overall workforce, and it's just a, so I guess I'm going to be guilty of the thing that you're going to accuse me of cutting corners on quality, but it's a big call to cut off a segment of the potential workforce and say we're not going to have that, or we're going to try and push that into a different sort of structure. So that was the essence of our conclusion was there's not a strong case to effectively take this platform arrangement and kind of shoehorn it into an employment relation or mandate that it has to be an employment relationship. It's not that it was without problems, because there are sort of gaps in accountability around the quality of care, and because there is a question is who is responsible for the quality? Is it the platform? Is it that there is notionally a provider sitting behind the arrangement? Is it them? Is it the individual that's been contracted through the platform? So it's not that there aren't issues with it that need some policy focus. It was more just on that fundamental question: should we have a restriction on this form of contracting?
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with the conclusion that you came to that there shouldn't be, because it's only a small proportion. Yeah. My point is though that I suppose it gets to that point of that I see so much stuff that is written by people who have some understanding of the system but not actually granular understanding, and my point was the exam where you say it's like the Allied Health Workforce,
yeah,
which operates, it's not, because of that missing of that quality framework. And I agree, I think for choice and control, if you're going to have choice and control, you shouldn't be mandating the method in which somebody is employed, but you still need to have protection of the vulnerable in terms of the quality of their outcomes.
Yeah.
And I think that was the piece that I felt was missing in that piece of work. Without wishing to be different to John Deagle and
say,
but
you acknowledge that it was a very important report on a difficult, complex subject. And,
we've got time for just one more question, but hold all the questions you've got, because we've got to have four more people to grill.
Right. Yeah.
And we'll just leave Michael up here by himself. Paul, just one more question for you.
I'm Paul Dugdale, Professor of Public Health at the ANU. We often look to overseas to improve our healthcare system. You know, the bureaucrats look to the NHS and the accounting, big four accounting firms look to the US. A lot of the kind of like economists often look to New Zealand. The well-being framework that they've adopted got a good run last night in the federal budget. And I was a bit surprised that you didn't kind of like wax on about it today, but just interested in your thoughts on whether a wellbeing framework might help us take productivity and healthcare forward.
I think that is the fundamental question. Would it make a difference? So I think wellbeing frameworks have an important role to play, no question. And in a way, perhaps contrary to popular belief, an organisation like the Productivity Commission, because we are, sorry to bore you with the minutiae, but because we're microeconomists, we're actually quite familiar with the sort of wellbeing framework. It's probably the macro side of the profession that tends to get a bit fixated on GDP per capita as the sort of proxy for wellbeing, right? In one sense, you know, when we've looked at things like mental health, for example, if you look at our mental health report, and I'm not going to get the figures right, but we looked at what was the cost or the burden of mental health, quantified it, but then made it clear that only a very small fraction of that was actually in the form of foregone productive, GDP per capita because of, lack of workforce participation, etc. The rest of it was just the burden of the disease, right, in terms of, admittedly some probably slightly strained concepts like quality adjusted life years and everything, but an attempt to get at how could we put a value on the well-being that isn't kind of effectively captured by the headline economic measure, GDP per capita. So I think well-being is an important lens. I think well-being frameworks can be good. There was a good chapter in the budget last night, that statement 4 in budget paper 1, that discusses the way different countries do it. New Zealand's one, the OECD's got a framework, a number of OECD countries have got it. I think the question is, do you try and come up with a composite indicator that's sort of the all-conquering alternative to GDP per capita? I think that's hard because it requires you to place weights on different things and say, you know, life expectancy is more important than, you know, school achievement or whatever it is, or the environment or, you know. So I reading through Statement 4, it looked very much as though it's more about broadening out the conversation beyond the headline economic measure of income per capita, looking at some other indicators, looking behind the aggregates. And I think that's all to the good, you know, identifying what it is that we're trying to achieve through public policy and, you know, being accountable for it through some metrics, really good thing. I think it is an open question, and it would be an interesting thing to pose to policymakers in New Zealand, because I often pose this to people about wellbeing frameworks in Australia. What exactly has changed? Can you point me in the direction of a decision which would have gone this way, and now it's gone this way? And I think that's a harder question to answer. So in terms of the final bit of your question, I think it's hard to know would it make a big difference in the direction of health policy. I'm not sure. You know, it maybe it would, and I'd be interested in the views of others, but you know, I'm not ruling that out. But it's I think it's a good way of assessing overall performance. Does it change behaviour? Yeah, that's the big question.
Thank you so much, Michael. And we're going to go to a quick break, well, about 30 minutes. We've got afternoon tea, and we'll be coming back for a panel discussion. If I can get you all put your hands together and thank Michael.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Health Advocate podcast. You can follow the Health Advocate podcast on SoundCloud or on your podcast provider of choice, and follow AHHA at AusHealthcare or find us on LinkedIn. You can also find out more about AHHA on our website at ahha.asn.au. Thanks for listening.